This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you in part by Kaylin and Ellie. You can become a Bladder Presents tipster at patreon.com/bladderpresents. And now, the episode.
The calendar changed. We didn't have any more 3rd of May, 4th of May, 5th of May. We have first day Madeline disappeared, second day, third. We counted the days for the days that Madeline was vanished.
Well, Netflix's 8-part series, The Disappearance of Madeline McCann, actually finally moved the ball on the 2007 vanishing of the 3-year-old from a Portuguese resort? Or, as Madeline's parents claim, will it only thicken the fog of misinformation around this still unsolved case? And 2014's documentary on missing Iowa paperboy Johnny Gosch, Who Took Johnny, doesn't have a question mark in its title, but there's a handful of big ones at its center. Send us some clues written on dollar bills. It's The Bladder Presents, episode 92. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, a podcast examining the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. If I need to let my guests know I'm alive, I'll make sure to write it on a 20. Welcome back, Eve Beatty.
Just a 20, Sarah?
Well, how often do you see a 50? Not that often.
I was going straight for a Benjamin, but whatever. Well, that's fine.
That's true. You are in retail. I guess those are... I'll send a little stack.
Thanks.
Origami communication. Okay. Let us, oh my God, really? listeners, I'm being, quote, assisted today by a couple of gray felines. And so if you hear meowing and screeching in the background, that's not me, that's the cats. As I was saying, let us get into it with our most wanted selection. The Disappearance of Madeline McCann. This is not actually all that recent a property. I think it's been out a few weeks now, a month.
March 15th
okay.
is when it dropped.
So yeah, a few weeks. But I feel like it's still top of mind for a lot of true crime consumers. And I definitely wanted to check it out. Here's the case file adapted from Wikipedia. So first of all, brick of salt. And second of all, I hope you packed a lunch because it's kind of impossible to summarize all the shit going on with this case in like a tweet length summary. Madeline McCann disappeared on the evening of the 3rd of May, 2007, from her bed in a holiday apartment in Praia da Luz, a resort in Portugal, sparking what one newspaper called the most heavily reported missing person case in modern history. Her whereabouts remain unknown. Madeline was on holiday from the UK with her parents, Kate and Jerry McCann, her 2-year-old twin siblings, and a group of family friends and their children. She and the twins had been left asleep at 8:30 in the ground floor apartment, while the senior McCanns and their friends dined in a restaurant about 200 feet away. The parents checked on the children throughout the evening until Madeline's mother spotted her missing at 2200 hours. That's 10 o'clock. Over the following weeks, particularly after misinterpreting a British DNA analysis, the Portuguese police came to believe that Madeline had died in an accident in the apartment and that her parents had covered it up. The McCanns were given arguido status, that's formal suspect status in Portugal, in September of 2007, which was lifted when Portugal's Attorney General archived the case in July of 2008 because of a lack of evidence. The parents continued their investigation using various private detectives until Scotland Yard opened its own inquiry, Operation Grange, in 2011. The senior investigating officer announced that he was treating the disappearance as a, quote, criminal act by a stranger. Most likely a planned abduction or burglary gone wrong. The investigation continues, but as I said, the disappearance remains unsolved. Okay, when I called this up to start watching it to prepare, I was dismayed to find that it was 8 nearly an hour episodes. I don't know why I thought it was only 4. Part of this is because, you know, obligatory watching for this project. Sometimes you're like, can we just have a nice trim 22 minute Forensic Files that covers this case? So part of that is on me, but part of it is that I did not follow this case closely at the time and have I am aware of the case, but historically really was not like following the various ins and outs of it on a contemporary basis. And I just didn't think that they were going to be able to get 8 worthwhile hours out of it. I am still not sure that it succeeded at this length and structuring. Eve, what did you think of, generally speaking, the series in terms of the length and its general organization?
Well, I too was not excited to see that it was 8 episodes, just because.
Sorry.
Just because with the first episode, I was like, I could already tell, and this is going to sound weird because I'm a journalist, I could already tell that the filmmakers were approaching this with a lot of journalistic rigor and a lot of sort of what colleagues of mine in the journalism field refer to as sort of like the wither the mollusks. Like, we are going to follow every detail down to the end and explain it all to you so you understand it. We're not leaving any, you know, sort of lead or aspect of the story. We're not glossing over anything. And that's good. That's great. You know, especially like, you know, when we get to our cold case, you know, we'll see why, you know, the opposite sort of a decision in terms of like, you know, creating a story doesn't work. But what that means is, like, you really have to pay attention. And I don't know about you, but I would sort of like zone in and out. Then I'd sort of like perk back up when I'd hear something. I'd be like, wait, what the fuck? And then I'd have to come back. Then I'd have to rewind it. So like, I wasted way more time too, because I would like start doing other things or whatever. Cause I was just like, oh my God, you know, yet another gorgeous Portuguese reporter is talking about something, you know, do we need, there isn't any sort of lead or aspect of the story that I think like, well, you know, shit, they should have cut this.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to answer it's like say, well, this is how I would have made it better.
Well, I will say it was compelling. I was interested. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't get to the end of an episode and be like, okay, phew. You know, like I was engaged pretty much the whole time. But here's where I think you make a good point about the journalistic rigor, because I think the issue is not in the relative length. I think it's that this is made as though it is not on a streaming service and people are not watching it second screen. So you have a lot of, there's not like red herrings necessarily, but they begin at, you know, at the very beginning. It is, as they say, a very good place to start. And they proceed to follow all of the stories that are branching off on a chronological basis, which isn't necessarily an issue. But if you are sort of tempted to Google ahead and see what becomes of this chief investigator, Amaral, or what ended up happening with Murat, this like neighbor who was serving as a translator and then quickly became, you know, sketcho number one in the eyes of the local constabulary. If, you know, they follow these things very carefully and chronologically, and that's not, it doesn't dissolve tension, or it didn't for me. And it doesn't, I don't think it takes anything away from the pacing, but it seems like there's an almost willful refusal to like cut anything or take a position on anything. Like, again, journalistic rigor, fine. Mm-hmm. But it, like, I'm not sure here in 2019 that like nobody is sitting in a movie theater sort of like taking this in as a Nicholas Nickleby length single experience during which they're not Googling.
I'm like, if I were to completely guess, and I'm probably wrong, my guess is that everybody who worked on this project has a journalism background and isn't like a, like, you know, we got to make our numbers sort of journalist. Mm. And then when I think you have like sort of the, you know, how like sort of in my opinion, long form journalism changed when it moved from print to online, because once you're online, you don't have to worry about column inches and, you know, actually spending money on paper. You can write as long as you fucking want. Mm. And so I sort of felt like that sort of similar thing when online journalism sort of first took effect and we saw like these zillion sort of screen stories. I wish that there had been an old school editor who had sort of come in and said, this is what we're going to move here. This is what is going to go here. Like by an editor, I mean like a newspaper editor,
right?
You know, someone who was like a front page editor and said, this is how it's going to go here. And this is how it's going to go here. I think another problem though is the platform. I think that if this had been a show that was doled out every week, and I'm sorry to suggest this because I know I sound old, but if this had been doled out every week, not only do I think it would have been more manageable than, you know, watching it all in a row as we all do on Netflix, but I also think that it would have generated more attention and more discussion, because it is the sort of thing, given how detailed every presentation was, right down to like showing you maps, like the logistics between where the restaurant was and, you know, oh, this is where the apartment was, this is the suspect sketch. I feel like this is the sort of thing that people on Reddit and other places would have made great hay over. People like you and I, who maybe since we're not from either Portugal or the UK, haven't, you know, really chewed it over. So I think that it suffered because it's a Netflix show.
That's possible. I think that also there were attempts to provide context, sort of going back a few years in terms of other cases that involved the disappearance of a child that Amaral had presided over. There were references to.
I love that story though. I want another show on that story.
Yeah, and there was also a. What was the other case that I was thinking of? Oh, yeah, that there's this one of the private investigation firms that the McCanns hired after the Portuguese police were like, well, we don't know, so bye. Like, they D.B. Coopered the case after a year.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Wait, you know, all right. That they're like, well, if you don't believe our theory, we don't have another theory. And they shelved it. So the McCanns start hiring private investigation firms. The second one was headed up by this guy who, it turned out, was just perpetrating a massive fraud on every level. And a good half an hour of screen time is devoted to that guy, which is not a bad thing necessarily, but it also raised a bunch of questions about the technology that the McCanns tended to rely on. And then didn't really answer them. And then the guy who's heading up this firm and pretending that he's like, you know, connected all the way up to the Oval Office and all the way across to the Kremlin turns out to be just some schmuck who's not even from the US and goes to jail and dies. Spoiler, I guess. And it's like, now that is a series that I want to watch. But while I respect how much of their work they showed, this did feel a little at times like, prestige true crime / history that is like, I physically took my ass to this small town where some of these things happened and walked around in the square, and my observations about what it is like to be in this town are going into the manuscript. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not killing any of my.
No darlings were killed in the making of this series.
Yeah. And again, it's not uninteresting, but I'm wondering if maybe they shouldn't have, as you say, first of all, tried to place it somewhere like HBO, which would have, like the case against Adnan Syed, parceled it out week by week, or just sort of regrouped the episodes so that it was less chronological and more like topic driven, I guess, because the same sorts of things keep coming up over and over again and then are not necessarily, but they're not always grouped together. Like, you have one guy who used to run Sky News making sort of general pronouncements about how the media's effect on cases like this, but then these observations are separated by five or six episodes. So
yeah
I just wonder like I'm reading this biography of Michael Jackson right now. That's like The Strange Life and Death of Michael Jackson. And it is over scrupulously researched, but part of me keeps feeling now that I'm on the 110th page just of probate wrangling after his death, that I'm like, maybe you wanted to just shave off one topic. Like, this is Michael Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Cut yourself a narrower slice so that it's a book that I can lift. I don't know. Maybe that's just me. One of the issues that they, I guess, raise, but then almost avert their eyes from, is the question of the parents' responsibility. Not did the parents do it, which I think, again, the series is maybe reluctant to take a position, but seems to believe that this is not what happened. But the fact is, the situation on that night was that the kids were in their room in their rental apartment. The parents were sort of within sight of the apartment across the pool at a restaurant. And every 20 minutes, half an hour, one of the parents would get up and check the kids. And all the parents were doing this for like all the various kids. And at the 10 o'clock check, Madeline McCann comes up missing. So there has always been this, like, at least a whiff, but usually a stench of judgment of the parents. Not that they did it, but that they shouldn't have left the kids alone. So here's a clip in which a journalist is sort of talking about how this was not uncommon practice. Clip two.
That summer, we'd been away in Mallorca, and we'd left the listening device on in our room and gone down to a restaurant. And you go by the grace of God. We were down the road slightly with our daughter upstairs in the room of a hotel, 150, 200 metres away. Everybody did that, and all our friends would do that.
This was the one thing prior to revisiting the case with this series that I remembered about the coverage.
Well, I remembered that too, and I this is not casting judgment on anyone, and obviously the culture in Great Britain is different than it is ours, but that is the, you know, I was surprised to hear that, because even, so back when I was a nanny, which was in the 90s, you know, more than 10 years before the circumstances of this case, what they would do, what families that were wealthy or upper middle class or whatever would bring somebody like me, you know, a woman in her early 20s, because I was in my early 20s back then, and to whatever, to Myrtle Beach or Miami or, you know, Sandals or whatever. And then it would be the nanny that would watch like all the kids. Like people would like chip in and bring somebody. And this was like very common. Like I would see like other nannies with other groups, and, you know, we'd all hang out and trade stories, you know, just like anybody else. So, you know, I thought to myself, given how nanny centric, in fact, nanny, that's such a British word, right? How nanny centric British culture is. I was really surprised that something like that didn't happen. And I remember that sticking in my head when I heard about it, like, oh my God, what if I had been watching, you know, a kid and one of them been abducted? Well, thank God I'm out of that business and in the incredibly safe business of journalism now.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I was a little surprised that that was sort of the extent of the series commentary on this decision, because I think this is definitely different from current United States child rearing culture. I don't have any kids. I am not judging. I do think that that is different. But on the other hand, when you and I were little,
like, yes,
I think my parents sort of had a rough idea of where I was most of the time. But, you know, like, we also were in strollers that were made of, it was like an ace bandage strung between two metal poles. Nobody had a bike helmet. On a summer day, my mother, from sun up to sundown, assumed that I was in city limits, wrongly, sometimes. Like, there just wasn't this, like, constant checking. But on the other hand, I was not, you know, 3-4 years old. Like, I think at that time,
Well, one thing I did think of too is, and you know this too, since you live in a large city, you can tell when there are tourists walking around or driving around, because a lot of them seem to think that they're in Disneyland. And I just want to be like, no, you're in, you know, I live in San Francisco. You're in an active city where active city things are happening. You're not somehow protected because you're on vacation. But we see this again and again, right? People who walk, you know, over the edge of the Grand Canyon, because I think we somehow feel that if you're on vacation, all bets are off, all rules are off, and you're somehow invulnerable.
There is a, there is like a distancing of yourself from certain realities of where you are when you're on vacation. Like, if I can go to Vegas in August and have zero problem with the heat. Yeah. But if it's the same temperature in New York City, like, I'm in my basement with the animals and I'm not coming out until September. Mm-hmm. And that's just weather-wise. So I think there is like vacation brain. I also think that, you know, I don't have kids of my own, but many, many people I know have kids. I have a niece and nephew, and like this, these systems work fine 99.8% of the time.
Yep.
And when they don't, all of a sudden it's the parents' fault. Like, how mm-hmm. could you not be hovering over them every second? Like, mm-hmm. I just kept thinking, I mean, and they also kept bringing up, Eitan Peetz, which I thought was so, so interesting, because I was basically his age when that happened. And I'm, you know, it wasn't a non-event, but what I mostly remember from that time was like grown up sort of feeling like, well, that's why you move out of New York to raise mm-hmm. your kids, which is what my parents did. That this was not a, there are predators after your kids problem. This was a, there are predators after your kids in New York City problem. Yeah. And the reference that I was surprised no one ever made at any time in this series was to JonBenet Ramsey.
Right. Right. I mean, that to me was so odd too, because, I mean, because of nothing else, once again, you know, it's a blonde, you know, child with big eyes. And also because, you know, again and again, it was discussed how this story is getting more coverage than other stories because this is a blonde child, even to the point that the, and we should probably talk about this more, the McCann's strange benefactor in his large red couch, you know, like deployed his son to Morocco because there, someone took a picture of a woman carrying a blonde child. And then it was like, God, I'll be damned. There are a lot of blonde kids in Morocco. And everyone seems so shocked like that. Yeah. Dude, guess what? I was blonde when I was a little kid too. Yeah. That happens.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole benefactor situation is a weird one, and we'll get back to that. But there were a number of ways that this was reminiscent of the JonBenet Ramsey case, not least that the amount of coverage or the manner of coverage, it wasn't just that it was a little blonde girl, although, you know, the family and friends of missing girls of color are within their rights to be like, actually,
yeah.
I mean, that's not nothing. But this was also like a little pageant queen. It was Christmas. Like, there were a lot of variables that turned that into a gigantic story. And in clip three, I think it's the founder of NCMEC and then a couple of other people are talking about why stories like this, sometimes you see this like exponential growth of interest.
What we've seen in the United States and elsewhere, and it's very frustrating to parents, is there's some cases that attract mass media, some cases that attract very little attention. My view was always that the determiner was the circumstance of the case. There was a transcendent case in the United States in 1979 in New York
Police and neighbors have combed the area around the missing boy's home at 113 Prince Street several times over to no avail.
A little boy named Eitan Pates. The image of that child was seared into the brains and the souls of millions of Americans.
What are your thoughts now? Do you think the kid is still alive? You think it's near here?
6 years old, abducted on the first day he was allowed to walk alone to the bus stop.
The chances, each day, the chances of a boy coming back alive are less and less.
I hope he's with somebody wiser than he, who will take care of him.
I mean, there were lots of other child abduction cases at that time. What was it about that case? The circumstance.
That case, JonBenet, and Madeleine McCann. And what this series sometimes seems unwilling to say is that I posit of the appeal, for lack of a better word, of the Madeleine McCann case is the myriad opportunities it afforded people to judge her parents. And the documentary does not go there, which is a choice.
Well, I mean, we do know that, and this is obviously very early in social media, God only knows what will happen if, you know, when the next time a case like this comes up now, that these people were besieged by dreadful comments on news articles. Mm. And like, you know, very early, I mean, Twitter, I think they said that, you know, Facebook had just been sort of available publicly for a few months and Twitter was in its infancy, but already people were glomming on it and saying like the most dreadful things about these parents. So, you know, yeah, I do think that that's something that they sort of made a point of and then sort of dropped after that.
Yeah. And the parents declined to be a part of this, and they made a statement on their website that basically said that they felt that this documentary was not helpful to the investigation. Although what this series does quite successfully, I think, is continue to subtly raise the question of whether it is possible to investigate this case at this point. And get any results realistically, given how sort of long it was before people without a dog in the hunt of either protecting Portuguese tourism or fixing mistakes that they made in a prior investigation or whatever their angle was. I would say that I don't think it's realistic to start at the beginning of this investigation and go over it all, over all of these sightings and these identikit drawings over and over again. I'm not sure that that's going to be possible, not least because of how much attention the case has gotten and the fact that, you know, the Reddit herring culture has had hold of it for over a decade. But the thinking does seem to have shifted to the idea that the parents were not involved and that this was, a planned abduction. I would like to talk a little bit about certain preconceived notions of what these crimes are after we listen to clip four.
People staying here. I keep coming back to the question, which was there on the very first day, which is how is it possible for some stranger to know that those children are alone, go in, remove one child without waking up the others, or apparently waking up the child that they're taking. They then make their way out again. They don't know for sure when the next person from the dinner party is going to come up and in through those doors. They're going out into a lit street. I guess the only conclusion you can draw is that somebody was watching that apartment. Somebody planned it.
I don't think that's a way off base conclusion, but the series is also good, I think, at sort of hanging a light on the things that investigators and press now assume about a child abduction case, that, you know, it either definitely is the parents or it most certainly is not the parents. And it is the work of a almost fictionally organized and far reaching pedophile ring. So I thought that was interesting. Just the evolution of the story.
Well, with, you know, and you know, the more that we talk about it, the more I am seeing things that could have been cut or sort of like compressed, like in addition to, you know, what you were saying about the scammy detective. They could have just, they didn't need to follow all of his investigation, everything, but they could have been like, hey guys, they hired this detective and he raised these questions, but it turns out he was a scammer. So it was all bullshit. Mm. There you go. I just saved you guys like 45 minutes.
Yeah, that's true.
And you know, we can say the same thing about all of the details on how these dogs were used to, you know, to find stuff. And I was happy to see a dog.
Me too.
The dog kept showing up. It was like this big, Eddie was the name of the dog. Mm-hmm. So Eddie's like running around. He's smelling blood. He's doing all this shit. He's, in my opinion, acting like a normal dog. Mm-hmm. And so we watch Eddie doing all this stuff for a long time. Then it turns out, oh no, Eddie was probably mishandled. And his, you know, handler, who we get to see like Eddie kissing his handler and all this stuff. They really love each other. But like the handler probably sort of misdirected him and stuff. And I'm like, we really spent an hour like with Eddie.
Yeah. And look,
so like,
Eddie's cute, and good job, Eddie, yeah. And you too, Kaya. But that was sort of a lot of time to be like some of the science, quote unquote, that we as true crime consumers rely on to draw conclusions about unsolved cases doesn't necessarily prove what we want it to prove. I mean, the dogs alerted on the smell of some kind of blood or cadaver material. I mean, what can we conclude from that? Almost nothing, unfortunately. So, yeah, that was a little like, if your point is that hopes kept being raised and then mm-hmm. and then dashed again about whether this case would be solved. Uh-huh. Like we're already on like episode 5. We got it.
Yeah.
Anyway, let me just play the dog related clip, jumping ahead to number 7.
With blood, crime scene investigators have been to the house and somebody has cleaned the blood up to the point where nobody can see it. That doesn't mean there isn't any there to find. With floorboards, some blood might drip through the gap and
Morning, John.
Run around the back of the floorboard, which won't be able to be seen, but it'll still be there. The odor will still be coming through the gap in the floorboards, and the dog will pick it up and be able to respond to it.
I mean, this is presented to us like so matter-of-factly, and this is early on. This is episode 3 when, you know, we're told all this. So I'm like, well, great. I mean, then the parents must have done it. Why hasn't anybody done anything about this? And then it's not until later on. It's like, oh, yeah, but, you know, this is how it went wrong. And so, yeah, to, like, you know, our earlier discussion on how could this have been changed, if they just sort of said, okay, so the dog did this, the dog indicated this, but, you know, it turns out it didn't work out, as opposed to being presented with this matter of fact, this is how it works, this is how it's going to be, it's, you know, it's cut and dried like anything else. Of course, while I'm watching it, I'm like, there could be anything in this room. You know, I know dogs really well. This dog could be freaking out about anything. It doesn't matter how well trained he is.
Yeah. Also, it's a vacation property that presumably is deep cleaned maybe twice a year. That blood mm-hmm. could have been from somebody who physically built the property. If your if your statements about the dog's ability to scent on like ancient materials is accurate, and by your, I mean that we are hearing in that clip from the handler, and I don't recall hearing from anyone else who was not the handler who said, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt, we can conclude from scent dogs alerting on X, Y, and Z that 1, 2, 3. We're hearing from the guy who's like basically making a pitch for his own business. So I don't know.
I feel a little bad because I really did like Eddie and I really did like how he treated Eddie. But I mean, how dog stuff works is a dog, like, you know, cadaver dogs, how they work is a cadaver dog signals in a spot and that's where you dig. How a drug sniffing dog works is a drug dog signals and that's why they open your bag. You don't go to jail because a drug dog signaled. They don't say, well, the body must be here because a cadaver dog signaled. It's just a sign that suggests where you need to look.
Yeah.
So, you know, no one said, all right, let's pull up the carpet and, you know, pull out these floorboards and see what's in here. You know, like there, you know, nothing conclusive like that came of it. It's just a dog did something.
And they did say that. They did say that in the series. Someone was like, so, you know, nobody, like the dog does not get up on the witness stand and be like, yeah, that's when I barked.
Right.
Like you have to find, you actually have to find something where the alert took place or, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly.
The other sort of overarching theme or organizing principle of this, by which I mean that it, you know, it sort of kept coming up and it did sort of feel like maybe this should have been the coverage of the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, was the effect of the media on the case, the effect of the media on itself. Regarding this case, we have heard from a Portuguese journalist who was very involved in case coverage from the beginning. We heard from her up top. And now we're going to hear from this guy from The Sun who is talking about, I guess, responsible headline writing in clip 5.
A tabloid take on news is not one that necessarily stimulates the intellect. It stimulates the emotion. You're stimulated from the moment of the headline or the moment of the lead of the telecast. That when you read something, you say, my God. He turns out to be an estate agent. Guilty. He turns out to have a bit of a dodgy eye. Guilty. He turns out to want to be helpful. Double guilty.
You have to put the whole Robert Murat's case, you know, that he's a slightly unusual looking fella and he had an ex-wife back in England and a daughter the same age as Maddie, which was even more strange.
Flying over the apartments from the east, we travel down the road and after a couple of seconds, the villa where Robert Murat lives quickly comes into view. This was where police collected the man they describe as a formal suspect early yesterday morning.
The fact that it was almost line of sight from his house to the apartment, there was a feeling that maybe the family had been watched for a few days.
You know, another parallel with JonBenet in that you have a case where during a time when nothing in particular is happening, the coverage may create things that are happening out of nothing burger circumstantial coincidences.
Attention sex traffickers, this is a great time to abduct a ton of kids because nobody has time to cover your case right now.
Yeah, God. It's true, though. I mean, if you look at, and, you know, taking it out of the, like, child abduction realm, if you look at OJ, that was definitely a case where even on days where, like, there's no, like, the court was not in session. Or everybody's been sent out for, like, even during, like, the jury is at lunch and they're interviewing some, you know, someone who washed Faye Resnick's car one time. I can't believe I even still know that name. Like, that's insane. But that's what the coverage was like. This, like, you know, seizing on teeny little threads and bits of lint and somehow creating you know, straw men out of them. Like, I think Murat got a pretty big judgment against some newspaper consortium at the end of all this for being dragged through it repeatedly just for being nearby and speaking Portuguese.
Yeah.
And because that case or his involvement paralleled some other case, the Ian Huntley case, mm-hmm. where that guy had sort of put himself forward as very helpful. And then turned out to be involved. And this is definitely something profilers mention, that sometimes someone inserting themselves into the case early on is involved. I don't really know how well that holds up anymore, but this is how they started seizing on Murat. But also because there was really nothing else happening. So then the tabloids kind of need to keep creating some kind of change or some kind of tweak to the nothing that's happening.
And in addition, and they sort of like talk about this a little bit, and, you know, I think that if like there's something that you can sort of take away from this, how things were handled then, it's such a precursor to what we're dealing with in terms of fake news now,
yes.
Which is, you know, because, okay, so this is how the mechanism worked, everybody. Pay attention. Portuguese newspapers, which don't have the sort of libel laws that we have here in the US or in the UK, would basically just make up a lie. And then, because somebody else said it, newspapers in the UK, and even more broadcast than print, but broadcast journalists here would repeat it and be like, so it's been, you know, it was reported in the Portuguese blah, 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 that whatever, X, Y, or Z happened. We ourselves could not confirm this with officials, but so that way, you know, legitimate, I'm doing huge air quotes, you guys can't see me, legitimate journalists, we get to have our cake and eat it too. I've done this a million times. I am as guilty as anyone, because that way you get to have the salacious, likely garbage that came from another source, according to World Star, you know, Kanye did this. We were not able to confirm this with his reps. You can do that. So you're perpetuating the fake part of the news within your legitimate, you know, journalistic outlet. And so then when people see the story, they're like, well, you know, in whatever, in The Guardian. I mean, I hate to draw The Guardian into it, but it's the only legitimate publication, like super legitimate publication I saw mentioned during this thing. Mm-hmm. So, well, in The Guardian, they said that this was reported in a Portuguese paper. You don't know anything about Portuguese papers and what they're going. You just know that The Guardian presented this information. And so that's why I think that there was this sort of like cloud of bullshit that, you know, hung over a lot of this, because so many lies were being spun and then reblogged again and again. And then, you know, you think about how it was less of an issue now, but if this story were now, it'd be reblogged. And then it's that blog post that your friend shares on Facebook, and then somebody else just sees the headline and then they mention it, you know, and it goes on and on and on. And I think that, you know, this show was made just sort of as fake news was really on the rise. And I think that's one of the reasons, probably, that it was so, like, almost, you know, spectrum-y. And it's, we're going to tell you every detail, and we're going to tell you, you know, what seems legitimate and what doesn't.
Yeah, and we're going to sort of unpack every single allegation. Mm-hmm. And if there's nothing there, then we'll just say that. But, yeah, that's a good point, because I think you and I are more, I think it's much more of a reflex to understand how these things are like told and sold, as I keep mm-hmm. saying, that it's like, you know, the headline can be as vague and condemnatory as you want. And then once you've gotten the click, then you just have to hope that people read down far enough to the fig leaf of attribution that's like, well, we weren't able to confirm this, and we're not exactly sure if this translation is accurate, and et cetera, and so on. To mm-hmm. you know, we should also note for readers that Portuguese libel shield laws are da da da. But
exactly.
I mean, is that what happens? Like, we read the whole thing, but do most people? No. And are most people sort of quality control checking attributions while they're reading? No. Because
people have lives. People are interesting. People aren't like you and me. They're fun.
Well, and people are not necessarily as cynical about what you have to do to keep any yep. kind of like online reporting entity, no matter how aggregational, mm-hmm. going. So,
yeah.
You know, and like I'm not unsympathetic to these problems of construction and clickbait, mm-hmm. because, you know, I'm very sympathetic, but I also like there is a certain responsibility legally yeah. as well. So yeah, I mean, our last clip is this guy from The Sun, I think, again,
mm-hmm.
Talking about the fact that, you know, this is like journalism is a public trust, but also, you know, it's a business in clip 8.
The problem with journalism, it takes out the natural emotion out of you, regardless of what you think. This is a commercial animal. Your job is to serve the reader. The reader is fascinated by this story, therefore it becomes a major front page story and stays so.
Yeah.
Well, so I love this guy. He had, you know, I think he left the Sun in 94. So, you know, he was out of the game before things, you know, got sort of to where they are in terms of online media, social media, all that other stuff. But he ended up, they ended up convening this panel regarding coverage of this case in the UK, which, you know, if you look at it, the, you know, the UK is very sort of involved in, they, you know, obviously they fund the BBC and they're very involved in journalism. And if you look at like headlines from the UK today, you'll see how they intend to regulate social media platforms like Facebook. They've released this white paper on what they're going to do to make sure that, you know, to try to sort of stem the tide of fake news. But I think that this line and what this guy said is important because the people who made this show put it in here for a reason.
Right.
And what it is that, you know, we can say, oh, the problem is the media and the problem is the media and, you know, what the media has done to this family. But the problem is us. The problem is you and me, Sarah. The problem is everyone who's listening to this. The problem is all of us who click on these headlines. But we're not a problem that's going away.
Right. Well, and, you know, I talk about this on this podcast all the time. Like, what, you know, what is the responsibility of the true crime consumer to examine their own interest and their own motives for interest in a given case? What is the responsibility of the true crime consumer to make sure that they are vetting sources of things that they like to read for entertainment? And if they are not interested in, if this is entertainment and not research to them, it, is that quote unquote wrong? I mean, I don't think it is. I think human interest in crime stories is human. And unless there's some prurience, I certainly don't judge it. You know, how can I? I have a podcast and blog that reviews true crime. But these questions come up more and more often explicitly in true crime materials of late. Like, you know, what is the responsibility of, for example, the Act to, you know, be accurate to the, the narrative of what actually happened in the Blanchard family? What is the responsibility of these filmmakers to, without the parents' participation, lampshade the role of the media in the case and also the role of people who are watching this series in driving the media that covered this case?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do not have answers to all of these things or to particularly to any of these things, but I think this is the best thing this series does, is to continually surface these this conversation, because, you know, the fact of the matter is there is still this missing person, and the story kept hanging up on irrelevant like sidebars and stuff like that instead of focusing on the fact that nobody is looking for her in Portugal. Like, the case was put to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably the important takeaways. You know, while we're discussing the discussion of what it means to care about this case, the case is cold. So that's where I'm at with it. Generally speaking, though, as a true crime product, it is good. It is very watchable.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think happened to Madeline McCann based on this? Did that change your theory? Did you have a theory?
Well, okay, I will say, so the theory that I had going in was that one of the parents, maybe not even Madeline's parents, gave the kids Benadryl or something like that to get them to sleep, and that Madeline had a reaction and died, and they were scared of toxicology. Because in my opinion, that would be the only reason that you wouldn't be able to like cover up something, even though even then you could just say, well, the kid got into it. That was sort of like my theory going in. After watching this and seeing everything, though, I have to say I have no theory. Watching her parents, you know, really looking at them, even though, you know, we get plenty of footage of them, they do not seem to me to be people that are actively terrified that they are going to be caught. Of course, at this point, you know, everyone's told their story so much that even if it's a lie, they're willing to believe it. Watching Madeline's mother grow progressively more and more gaunt, watching how close and scared they seem to be, watching how their friends all support them, I have a really hard time believing that they were involved.
I don't think they were involved either. I think that any sort of guilty behavior markers that we might have seen are that, of course, in the absence of any other information about what happened to your child, you blame yourself, even if it's irrational, because that's a, like, that's a known quantity, right? I'm an expert in self-loathing, and this is my theory on that, even though I don't have kids. I think they were, I think the kids were given some kind of Benadryl-esque thing to help them sleep or stay asleep, or at least that was alleged, or that had happened in the past. Nobody seemed all that shocked by that, but again, we come from the generation where your parents would still put bourbon on your gums when you were teething. So what do I know? I don't think she wandered off. I think she was taken, and I think that she is not alive and has not been alive. But this is more like a theory born of, like, that's the most likely scenario under any circumstances. Like, the series did not really move the needle on what I thought had happened, but I do feel better informed, and I think she was taken. Someone had probably been watching the apartment for a couple days. We do find out in the series that the restaurant had a note next to the reservation saying that they wanted this table because they could see their rooms, and that they would be checking on the kids who had been left alone, and that Kate McCann was quite upset to find out that that was true. So I don't know. I don't know what happened, and I would say that we're never going to find out what happened, but we did sort of find out what happened to Eitan Peetz. It just took many, many years. So
yeah.
All right. Well, moving on to a cold case that really is a cold case and rather a weird one. Who Took Johnny is a 2014 documentary about the disappearance of Johnny Gosch in 1982. It is available on Amazon Prime. Here's the case file. Johnny Gosch disappeared off his paper route in West Des Moines, Iowa in early September 1982. Another paper boy disappeared nearby not quite 2 years later. A convicted sex offender claimed to have seen him at a way station of sorts in Colorado and that Gosch was sold to a pedophile ring. Gosch's mother, Noreen, claims he came to see her in the late 90s but was unwilling to undisappear because he feared reprisals from his kidnappers. There aren't many undisputed facts in this case except these. Gosch's picture was the second, after Eitan Peetz, to appear on milk cartons, and West Des Moines PD were intransigent on the subject of Gosch having run away versus been abducted. Johnny Gosch's disappearance remains unsolved. And if Adam Walsh couldn't move the ball, I'm guessing it is likely to stay unsolved. Had you heard of this case before?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, especially just because, like, you know, you mentioned Peetz, but I think I'm right around the same age as this kid. I grew up in the Midwest. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I feel like this was the sort of you know, boogeyman that was sort of presented to us. You can be out riding your bike in rural Indiana and get taken. Look at this kid where it happened in Des Moines.
Mm. I don't think I had heard, I think I heard of this documentary because Netflix did one of those more like this recommendations and mm-hmm. I noted it down and then it left Netflix. But like I said, it is available on Amazon Prime for rental and purchase. And it may be on Hulu. I actually did not check. We'll have a link in the show notes. But I did not recall the case, even though he was 12 when he disappeared. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, around the same age as you and I, but was not something that I guess made it out east. I don't know. This documentary, I mean,
dude, it's not good. It's not good.
No, it's really not. It's by a group of three directors who have directed a couple of properties that I've heard of and been trying to track down, including Code 33, which is about Cuban detectives in Miami working some cold case, I believe. If anyone knows where I can find that, let me know. I've had no luck. But it's very, I don't know. I don't really know where to start. Like, it's very watchable, but then they keep springing things on the viewer that it, like, sort of late in the game. And also, I think they've decided to just believe Noreen in exchange for her participation and not really comment on her credibility at all. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you found this bad?
Well, so when I was like doing some research after I watched this, I noticed that a lot of the reviews for it mentioned that it made a really big stir at Sundance. And so I think this is how it got distribution, was that sort of the festival frenzy.
Mm.
I think that it's likely that if it hadn't been like a Sundance sensation, which it apparently was, we would not be talking about this. We wouldn't know about it. It would be one of those things on Amazon Prime that is like way down there in your recommendations list and you never get to it. So that's why it's here, and that's why it sort of has legitimacy. But, you know, Joe Reed could do a whole separate podcast in addition to his This Had Oscar Buzz podcast on This Had Sundance Buzz stuff that we've all forgotten,
yes,
right?
This came out of Sundance at 2,000 degrees, yeah, Kelvin, sure.
And yeah, exactly. And so apparently, you know, based on like the review I read like in The Hollywood Reporter and Variety, this came out of it similarly.
Mm.
So, you know, but then when you watch it now and you're not at the festival, you're just like at your house in San Francisco, the person now, all you see is a show that shows that sort of dismissed the whole idea I had when I was watching the documentary about Madeleine McCann. At the end of it, I thought to myself, well, it's fine for them to continue to have hope that she's alive. There's nothing wrong with that. That is perhaps a more comforting way to live than the alternative. And then I turned this on and I was like, never mind. I take it all back. Nobody should have hope. You should just accept that your kid is gone, because then you'll end up being Noreen.
Yeah. Well, and this is another one where it's like, I have, you know, enormous compassion for Noreen, but something has gone wrong synaptically, I would say.
Look, props for keeping the same hairstyle,
yes,
for 30 years.
And, yes, and her whatever she is use, whatever her shampoo regime is, it's extremely impressive. Look, it's really hard, Eve. I'm sure you can understand, for me to shit on a documentary in which one mm-hmm. of the clues is allegedly that he wrote "I am alive" on a dollar bill and signed it, like. That is bunt nip, like communicating through currency. Love it.
Yeah.
However, the documentary is about 80 minutes, and it does seem like it only really has a couple of like central like tent poles, one of which is that, as I said, West Des Moines PD was really refusing to believe that he was a runaway, mm-hmm. or that he wasn't a runaway, that he had been taken. and their stated reasons for believing this are perhaps not relatable here in 2019. Here's a clip.
There was no crime scene. Nobody saw anything that to us was an explanation for the boy's disappearance. He just vanished. This is just that unsolved, unexplained missing person case.
You know, the trail gets cold real quick. And they just saw, like all cops do, it's a runaway. A kid ran away. Now, this kid didn't run away. Johnny was our paper boy. I knew him, knew his parents, been out to dinner with him. Johnny would not run away.
Altogether, we had five witnesses that each saw this crime that took place. And the cops stated again, has your son ever run away before? They were completely excluding the fact that we had witnesses.
I mean, talk about a, you know, Rashomon problem. Like, first of all, mm-hmm. this is not an unexplained disappearance. You have an explanation available. You do not wish to avail yourself of it, even though it is a crime and you are the police, but fine. And then on the other end is the mom who's like, well, we have five witnesses to this crime occurring. Like, no, that's not what you have witnesses to. You have witnesses to him speaking to a man in a car. You have witnesses to him cutting across a yard. You didn't see him get kidnapped. Like, the truth is somewhere in the middle. That's how it goes with a lot of these cases. I'm not sure there's 80 minutes worth of documentary here. If the documentary is going to be completely unskeptical of Noreen and of her, of the, like, sort of Hail Mary Paul Benassi testimony that implies that there's a pedophile Illuminati operating out of Omaha.
Well, and
is
the
sentence
that, you know,
that I just said.
Well, and Omaha's the place to do it. But I mean, we do. This is like.
I had a nickel.
I think that, you know, once again, in our current troubled time. So this documentary is from 2014, which seems like so long ago. Sarah.
It really can sometimes, especially with this stuff where. Yeah. Anyway, continue.
But the world and how we thought about things was different. You know, conspiracy theories, if you said something about conspiracy theories in 2014, it was like, oh, well, you know, like Kennedy or something. Now it's like we live in a different world where things are so thick with conspiracy theories. And to me, that's the greatest value of this documentary, is for those of us who are like, oh, you know, all those dummies with QAnon or with Pizzagate or whatever else, right? You watch this documentary and you see how someone who probably started out, somebody like you and me, you know, except with much better hair and a much better yoga practice, you know, how they, through circumstances, probably both, you know, lurking internally, neurologically, and externally, can create a conspiracy theorist who is going nuts out of almost anyone.
Oh, yeah. Well, this goes back to, you know, it's something that I touched on earlier in this podcast that, you know, what is our responsibility as true crime consumers? And that's tied to why do people take an interest in true crime? And to some extent, with some kinds of stories, in my opinion, it is an attempt to learn as much as possible about a situation or various sets of circumstances in order to feel like you have some control over some chaotic evil that is essentially random and cannot be controlled. I am a nationally ranked control freak. I totally get it. And particularly if you are a secondary victim of a crime, and that your way of controlling your grief that can't even necessarily be assigned to a specific time or event, because there are still unknowns as to whether your loved one is dead or how that may have occurred if it did, that you begin to construct these Rube Goldbergian conspiracies that cannot be true, but sort of working on them mentally keeps you from falling into the abyss. So I understand how it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that it works as a narrative product. So there's that.
I don't think that it does.
I did enjoy, there was one, well, I'm just going to play this clip because I love that this guy, first of all, calls Noreen up and is like, I'm an expert on pedophilia. And she's like, who, what even is that? And then his extremely scientific theory for why, Johnny didn't run away is that he didn't take the dog, which sort of checks out. Here's clip 10.
I think people today would be shocked at what the real situation was in 1982. Police were required to wait 72 hours before they could start investigating for a missing child case. The FBI would track your stolen car across state lines, but it would not track your stolen child across state lines. There was absolutely no national infrastructure to support the hunt for missing children.
One of our big breaks in the case was the fact that a man by the name of Ken Wooden called me. And he was an expert on pedophilia.
I was in residence at Iowa State University, and an article came out in the paper. A newspaper boy, serving papers, missing, and his dog was still there. And it was obvious. If the dog was still there, he was no runaway.
I mean, on the other hand, then why isn't the dog, like, freaking out? Maybe the dog is taking a nap. I don't know. Dog sensor, a tough call with this stuff. Just kidding. I don't know. I just thought that was funny that that's sort of the level of expertise that you're talking about. But the first guy we hear in that clip is, I forget his first name, Paul Sparrow, who was a longtime producer on America's Most Wanted. I would love to have a documentary just about him, like the Sparrow Files. Or as the sparrow flies, and he sort of looks back at notorious cases that they covered, or I don't know, maybe he has a TED talk on things that he learned from producing the show. But I thought he had some.
We could call that From Inside the Sparrow's Nest.
Yes. Yes. My fellow last name that is also a bird. Call me Paul Sparrow. I would like to I would love to come to your TED talk. No matter how long it is. But I did think he had some good insights about this case, about the fact that it was a different time, that there was not this, like today, if he disappeared off a paper route, like first of all, remember paper routes? Remember when enough people got the paper? But now the assumption would be that this, you know, with this sort of disappearance, that like the kid is gone and all his stuff is still there and the dog is like chilling in the red wagon. Like, of course he got abducted. That's the first place your mind goes, not the last. Yeah. But he also talks about the fact that because the police didn't have a theory they liked better, they just didn't really work any theories at all. And I'm not sure what they could have done in any case, with forensic science being where it was in 1982. So here is a Sparrow again talking about how this case kind of haunts him all these years later.
So that there was this sense that we're really close, you know, something is going on here. But every time we found a clue, we ran into a brick wall. The owner of the house, which had been abandoned, was a former prison guard who disappeared. You know, the people who had composite drawings never became real people. We never had names. We never could go after them as individuals. We couldn't expose them and get them brought in for questioning. There's the things you think are true. There's the things you know are true. And then there are the things you can prove in court. And the only thing that matters is what can you prove in court. And we didn't have anything that we could prove in court. The Johnny Gosch case has haunted me, you know, in a way that nothing else that I encountered on America's Most Wanted has. And we encountered horrific crimes. If America's Most Wanted, with all of our resources, couldn't solve this case, then chances are no one would. And as I looked around, no one else was trying to solve the case.
He said a mouthful, but I just wanted to note that the line about there are things that you think you know and things that you know you know and things that you can prove in court, that he says that points up the contrast between this and the disappearance of Madeline McCann in terms of how like what they are willing to treat as fact and the perils of having parental involvement in a case like this, I think, are also underlined, perhaps unintentionally, by who took Johnny. Because Noreen, Noreen believes some things that I'm fairly sure can't be true and has probably been taken advantage of by people who do not have her family's best interests at heart.
But, you know, and this is something that came up once again with McCann, though, that, you know, when they had the one of the private investigators that was hired by the McCann family, it all the tips were going to his cell phone and he was getting calls constantly. And he said, I can't remember exactly the percentage, but didn't he say that like half of them were from mediums?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was something like it was either a third or a half. I can't remember. And, you know, I know that that is true in every case now. I'm sure it was true in every case back then, that there are people who are saying they had a dream, they had a feeling and all that. And when you're somebody like Noreen, who is so desperate for an answer, and, you know, she did have a supportive husband. I assume he was supportive back at the time of the abduction, but they parted ways. And it's sort of suggested in this documentary because of her, you know, inability to process this case. Not that anybody should be able to process having their kid abducted, but, you know, so this is all she's had to chew over. And so I think that you're exactly right that everyone who's come to her with the theory, she's like, well, then that must be it.
Mm. Including, we find out very late in the documentary, she believes that Johnny himself came to her with a theory of the case. Back in the late 90s, allegedly he appeared on her doorstep at 2:30 in the morning, I guess stood out on the stoop for an hour with a friend who was never identified, and then vanished again. None of this makes any logical sense to someone who has not been living at the center of this situation for the better part of four decades. But here is Noreen averring that it actually makes perfect sense in our final clip.
But knowing that he had gotten away from these people and probably didn't want them to find him again, I can totally understand why he only stayed for about an hour. I can totally understand why he slipped away into the night, wouldn't tell me where he was living, and a few things that were evasive. That was for his protection and also probably mine. But I kept that information to myself for 2 years before I was on the witness stand and had to answer the question for the attorney.
I mean,
what do you think happened here, Sarah?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think something happened. I don't think this was like a complete hallucination.
I think somebody came by. I mean, yeah. Johnny would look like Johnny. I think somebody came by, said, I'm your son, you know, for whatever. I mean, we recently had that case, right, of, you know, a mentally ill person who has repeatedly said that he was an abducted person. Mm. I think it could have been, you know, a combination of someone who is not well and, you know, or someone who wanted to see what they could get from her, or someone who is just fucking evil.
Yeah, she has not kept a low profile, which, you know, nor should she. I think a big part of her thing is like, if I don't keep agitating, nothing yeah. is going to get done. Unfortunately, I think the results of that agitation were certainly one of the sheriffs in the 80s who wound up getting relieved of command for various corruption and dereliction of duty reasons was just like said to a newspaper, I'm sick of her shit, and like rolled his eyes. And the reporter wrote that down, put it in the put it in the story. You'll see that in the visual aids. That's Blutter Presents on Facebook and Twitter. But I think she would have been easy to find and try to leverage for something.
Yeah.
And that it would have been clear. And then that sort of contact with this Paul Benassi guy that's another character. And he's like present day Paul Benassi is in the documentary and, you know, having made up and to like fraudulently alleged that the entire power structure of like Iowa and Nebraska were involved in a giant child sex trafficking ring. I mean, yeah, there's a lot going on here, and it's interesting, I guess, that this felt very long in places where the Madeline McCann series didn't, despite being, you know, 4 or 5 times the length. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to not recommend it. Like, the fact that you have to pay to watch it, that'll be its own barrier to entry. But Who Took Johnny is like, it's very watchable, but then as it's unraveling around you, you're kind of like, why is that? It's an interesting case of why these things do or don't hold up, and the ability of a true crime property to maintain integrity on its own point of view in the face of an obviously troubled like protagonist, I guess, which I'm not sure. I think this tried but did not succeed.
Well, I think it's just, you know, this is like I'm so glad that you chose this as the cold case, Sarah, because this is these two shows are sort of a really good juxtaposition. If the Madeline McCann show has, you know, so much journalistic rigor that it can sometimes feel like a slog, this didn't have any. And I think that the filmmakers were maybe not up to the task of telling this story well, even, you know, within 80 minutes.
Yeah, I think perhaps with a little more experience a little more. I think that experience lets you take a slightly stronger stand with just pushing back on certain wild claims of people that you're interviewing, or not gotcha-ing viewers with this revelation that Noreen gotcha'd law enforcement with 20 years ago that she had seen her son, or, you know, maybe try to do your own investigation, interview some other people who wrote a book about it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Didn't happen here. I would be interested to see another filmmaker with a little more standing, I guess, for lack of a better term, take a run at this case. And try to do it from the beginning. Berlinger, Alex Gibney, anyone really.
Yeah.
All right. Well, sorry that one wasn't quite up to snuff, but I think it did. I think it did make a good contrast. You're right.
Yeah.
Eve Beatty, plug your shit. Where else can listeners find you and your works and days?
Oh boy. I have a store in San Francisco. It's called Avenues Dry Goods. We sell stuff from local artists and craftspeople as well as vintage items. So if you're ever in the city and you want to head out to the beach, stop by. We're Avenues Dry Goods on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, but we really only do Instagram, so that's the only one you should pay attention to.
All righty. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, we are Columbine with Toby Ball, and later, extremely wicked, shockingly evil, and Jeb Lund, Joe Berlinger's second Ted Bundy project. Until then, got a tip for The Blotter Presents. You can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com, and you can become an official Blotter tipster at The Blotter's Patreon page, patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, I'd love it if you tell a friend and rate it on iTunes to make it easier for other listeners to find it. Find us. If you don't like the podcast, I'd love it if you would keep that information to yourself. My guest has been Eve Beatty, and she is on Twitter at Eve B. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.